This chazar is echnash b'chayes hashag. Remember, Yehudim says the ksuba tafkuv yud. Zok the mishnah. If a creditor has a loan document against a debtor, and the debtor produces a deed showing that after the due date of the loan, the creditor sold him a piece of land, Adman says the debtor can say if he truly owed him the money, the creditor would never have sold him the property and would have just instead taken the money for the payment of the loan. The Chum say that the creditor can claim that he sold it because he felt that it would then be easier to take back that land than payment of the loan. The Gemara says, in a place where in a real estate transaction the money is given over before the deed, all would agree the debtor can say that if he really owed the money, then the creditor would have just taken the money that was given to him as a purchase. He would have just taken it for the loan and not given over the deed. The machlek is in a place where the deed is given before the money. Admei says if he sold it with intent to later collect the loan, he should have just told someone that was his intent. The rabbanans don't expect him to tell others of his intent because that would risk that the debtor would find out about his intention and not go through with the proposed purchase. Zok the mishnah. If a creditor produces a loan document against a debtor, and the debtor then shows that he has a loan document against the creditor dating after the other loan document, so Adman says that the debtor can say that if I truly owed you money, you would never have lent me money. The Chum say that each one can collect on his document. Zok Mar, if two people have outstanding loans against each other, Rav Nachman says each one collects a piece of the land from their debtor. Rav Sheish says there's no reason to move property around for no reason. Rather, the loans just cancel each other out, and everybody stays with their own properties. Zok Mar all agree that if they have the same quality of land, there's no reason to have them just switch properties. Machlekes is where one has Bananist land, and the other has Zeburius land. Rav Nachman says that when a creditor collects Bananist land, this means he takes Bananist based on the debtor's other lands. Therefore, the one with the Zeburius land will end up with the land that is superior in his eyes, and the one with the Bananist land will end up with land that is inferior in his eyes. Rav Sheish says that a creditor always collects what's Bananist in the world in general. Therefore, the creditor who owns the Zeburius land will take Bananist land from the other person, who will then take that Bananist land back for his loan. Therefore, there's no point in giving the land just so that switching back and forth, so everyone just keeps the land just the loans just cancel themselves out. Now, in fact, according to Rav Nachman, maybe the creditor with the Bananist land will come first and take the Zeburius land, and he can then give back that exact land to the other person for his loan. So he's talking about where the one with the Zeburius land made his claim first. In fact, when they present their claims to Bezdin at the same time, Bezdin would not allow the one party to collect first when it causes a loss to the other party. Mar says, you're right, okay, the case must be where one party has Idius and it has Idius and Bananist, and the other party only has Zeburius. In that case, Rav Nachman would hold that whichever party collects first, the result will be that one who owned the Zeburius will end up with Bananist, and the one who owned the Idius and Bananist will end up with Idius and Zeburius. So Sheshes would hold that since we give a creditor what is universally considered average land, the Bananist land itself would simply be passed back and forth, and therefore the loans simply cancel each other out. The Gemara Mishnah says that the Chachamim say that each party collects his loan. This refutes Rav Sheshes. Rav Nachman explained that according to Rav Sheshes, we would say that the cases where one loan was for a 5-year term, the other one was for a 10-year term, one was due before the other, and therefore we certainly allow the earlier maturing loan to be collected before the other loan becomes due. If the first loan was not yet due and the second loan was taken, Admin would not have said that the second loan proves that the first loan was non-existent because the loan was not due yet. It must be that the case is where the first loan was due when the second one was taken. If so, why did the Rabbanan say that this does not prove that the first loan is not outstanding? Mara says the case is where the second loan was taken on the day of the expiration of the first loan. The Rabbanan say it's possible that the first creditor would borrow money even though he has money coming to him the next day. Adam says he would not have done that. Rabbi Mechamis said, Rav Sheshes can say that our mission is discussing where one of the parties are orphans of the original party. As orphans, they may collect their father's debt and don't have to pay their father's obligation if they didn't inherit the land. Therefore, it's not simply passing assets back and forth. In fact, the mission says that each of them collects their loan. The Mishnah means that one party collects and the other is entitled to collect but has no property to seize and therefore cannot collect. Rabbi has two questions. Number one is the Mishnah seems to say that both parties actually collect. Number two, we should allow the orphans to collect land, and then since they have land from that collection for their father, we should allow the other the creditor to then take back that land from them. This remains a kasha. Maybe we can say the cases where the orphans only have inferior land and the other creditor has average and superior land, in which case the creditor can always take inferior land because a creditor only collects inferior when collecting from orphans. Mar says, although he's only supposed to collect inferior land, if he seizes higher grade land, he would be allowed to keep it, and that's why we have to be careful with what we allow to happen. Zok the Mishnah, there are three separate lands in Eretz Yisrael for purposes that one cannot force his wife to move from one of them to the other. Yehuda, Eber, Yarna, and the Galil. One may not force his wife to move from a town in one to a town in the other, or from a city in one to a city in the other. However, one may force his wife to move from one town to another or from one city to another within the same land. Even within the same land, one may not force his wife to move from a city to a town or from a town to a city. So the Mishnah, one may force his wife to move from a bad dwelling to a good dwelling, but not from a good dwelling to a bad dwelling. Rashi Gamliel says a person cannot force his wife to move from a bad dwelling to a good one because it causes a person who is not used to that better type of living to become sick. Fact the Gemara, it makes sense that she can't be forced to move from a city to a town because there are less things available there. Why can't she be forced to go from a town to a city? This supports Rav Yossi, who says, who learns from a pasuk that it's difficult to live in cities because of the congested living conditions. Mishnah says, "Shimon Galil, I'm a bechulu." How is it that it causes someone to be sick just to change? The Mara says, like Shmuel says, that it causes a change in routine, and changes in routine cause sickness. Zok the Mishnah, a person can force anyone. Everyone, meaning anyone in his family, to move with him to Eretz Yisrael, but he cannot force anyone to leave Eretz Yisrael. A person can force his family to move with him to Yerushalayim, but he can't force anyone to leave Yerushalayim. This is true for men and women, meaning a wife can force her family, just like a man can force his family. Zok the Mishnah, if a man marries a woman in Eretz Yisrael and divorces her there, he pays her in Eretz Yisrael currency. If he married her there but divorced her somewhere else, he still gives her Eretz Yisrael currency. If he married her somewhere else and divorced her in Eretz Yisrael, he still gives her Eretz Yisrael currency. Shimon Galil says, in the last case, he pays her in the currency of the place of the marriage, meaning if that currency is more valuable, they have to pay her in that currency because he agreed to that currency in the Ksuba. If he married her and divorced her somewhere else, he pays her in that other currency. Fact number, what does the Mishnah mean when it says that you can force everybody to move? Terry Tisrael Jewish line, Mara says it means that even Jewish slaves can be forced to move. In fact, according to the version of the mission that explicitly says slaves, what's the everybody coming to include? Mara says it means to include even moving the family from a good dwelling outside Eretz Yisrael to a bad dwelling inside Eretz Yisrael. In fact, what does the mission mean to include when it says nobody may be forced to leave? It includes a slave who escaped his master outside Eretz Yisrael and ran to Eretz Yisrael. What does the mission mean to include when it says everyone may be forced to move to Yerushalayim? It means that even if they will have to move to a worse dwelling, still. What does it mean when it says that nobody may be forced to leave Yerushalayim? This comes to include that even if they are will be going to a better dwelling, still, since the earlier part of the Mishnah states the phrase of that nobody may be forced to leave, we say it over here as well. Bryce says if a wife refuses to move to Eretz Yisrael with her husband, he can divorce her without having to pay her ksuba. If he refuses to move there with her, he has to divorce her, and he has to pay her ksuba. Similarly, if she wants to leave Eretz Yisrael, he does not, he can divorce her without paying her ksuba. If he wants to leave and she does not, he has to divorce her and he has to pay her ksuba. The Mishnah says, Nashal Isha v'ksuba. In fact, the Mishnah seems contradictory. First, it says if they get married in Eretz Yisrael and divorce elsewhere, he pays the currency of Eretz Yisrael, because presumably, because that's where the obligation took place. Then it says if they get married elsewhere and divorce in Eretz Yisrael, he has to pay with the currency of Eretz Yisrael, which is mashmei, not with the currency where the obligation took place. Rabbi said, since ksuba is only derabbanan, we go to kula, we always allow him to pay with the less valuable currency. Mishnah Shimon Galil, Oymer v'chulu. Zmar says he holds that ksuba is deraisa. He has to pay with the higher currency if that's where the obligation took place. And Rabbi says, if a loan document was written with the location as Bavel, he pays in Bavel currency. If it's written at the location Eretz Yisrael, he pays with its currency. If it has no location written, he pays with the currency where it's presented for payment. If it just says that the debtor owes kesef without any amount, the debtor may pay back whatever he wants, but that's not so for ksuba. What was this last sentence said in regard to? Rabbi Shashia said it was written regarding the first part of the Braisa and excludes the view of Shimon Gamliel. Maybe affecting more the term kesef means that he owes her a bar of silver. But as I said, the case where it says coin and therefore can't refer to a bar of silver. A Braisa says a person should rather live in a city of a majority of goyim in Eretz Yisrael than a city of mostly yidden outside Eretz Yisrael, because we dash in a pasuk to teach that one who lives in Eretz Yisrael is considered to live with a god, and one who lives outside Eretz Yisrael is considered to be living without God, meaning it's as if he has worshipped Avodah Zarah. We see this in Pesukim regarding David as well.